Hi, this is Mimi Sheraton, author of 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, and you are listening to Radio Cherry Bomb.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm Aletra Wiedemann of Impatient Foodie, filling in for host Carrie Diamond, who is on tour for the Cherry Bomb Cookbook. She'll be in Durham on Monday night for a powerhouse panel with chefs Andrea Rusing, Katie Button, Vivian Howard, and Phoebe Lawless. You can find the ticket link on cherrybomb.com. I know she'd love to see you. Cherry Bomb also has a fun event coming up on Saturday, November 4th, that everyone can take part in. It's called the International Women's Supper Club, and the idea is that you and your girlfriends get together and cook. We want it to be the biggest supper club of its kind. Be sure to check the Cherry Bomb Instagram and website for more information and giveaways. So as I mentioned, my name's Aletra. I'm founder of a site called Impatient Foodie, which aims to marry slow food ideals with the realities of fast-paced urban life. And I've actually known Carrie for years before either of us worked in food. We both worked in fashion and then segued into food around the same time. I wrote for the first issue of Cherry Bomb. I was a moderator at one of the first Cherry Bomb Jubilees. I was on this radio show this summer when my book, Impatient Foodie Cookbook, came out. And now I'm here guest hosting again, and I'm so honored and thrilled. I love being part of the Bomb Squad. Thank you again for... Oh, guys, stop. Thank you. Thank you. You like me. I love you guys. And so I'm thrilled to be here, and I'm super thrilled to be talking today with our guest, who I'll get to in 1 second. But first, let's thank our sponsors. This season of Radio Cherry Bomb is presented by Le Cordon Bleu. Le Cordon Bleu is legendary. The legendary cooking school, which has locations around the globe from Paris to London to Ottawa. The schools have a wide array of programs available, from 9-month classical culinary training programs all the way to bachelor and master's degrees, which sounds awesome. I want to do that. Visit cordonbleu.edu for more. Also, Castor and Pollux is the maker of the brand new purposeful pet food line, Pristine. A lot of Bomb Squad members are proud pet parents, so you'll want to know about this grain-free line made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Visit purposefulpetfood.com for more. And make sure to tag your Instagram pup photos with hashtag CherryBombPets for a chance to win a year's worth of Pristine food for your pet. I'm totally going to do that when I get home because I have a little Chihuahua sidekick named Happy, who, as far as sidekicks go, is the most pathetic little being in the world. He's afraid of butterflies and ladybugs. He doesn't really do that much, but I love him so much, and I'm sure he'd love Pristine, so I'm going to do that when I get home. We'd also like to thank our friends at Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio for supporting our show. The Milk Street Radio podcast, which you can find on PRX, features some of our favorite women in the world of food. You can hear Dori Greenspan talk about making the perfect cookie, yum, Samin Nosrat weighing in on ways to make a great grilled cheese, double yum, and Sarah Moulton answering everybody's kitchen conundrums. Subscribe to Milk Street Radio on Apple Podcasts, Radio Public, or wherever you get your podcasts, or listen via your local public radio station. So, today's guest. I'm super thrilled to be here to talk with Nadine Levy-Redzepi, who is all the way here from Copenhagen. And it's been a really exciting week for this mother of three. Her first cookbook, Downtime Deliciousness at Home, was just released this Tuesday. And it's a look at how Nadine really cooks for her family, which happens to include Noma chef and founder Renee Redzepi. Nadine is a part of the Noma family, having worked a number of jobs at the restaurant from service to reservationist. And we have a lot to talk about, so let's get into it. Nadine, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thank you.
And
I'm
New York.
I'm so excited. Thank you.
Have you been to New York before?
Woo! I have been here a number of times. I love it here.
Oh, nice. Well, congratulations.
So much good food.
Yes, lots of good food. And a pizza right in front of us.
Amazing.
So I wanted to get right in, and your cookbook is so beautiful.
Thank
I was
you.
Reading it yesterday, and one of the first things I noticed is their intro is by your husband.
Yes.
And in it, he talks about how one of the first dates you guys had, you cooked him a pasta with chicken livers and a tomato sauce, which happened also to be a dish that his mother had cooked for him. And when I was reading that, I thought, oh, that must be like his Proustian Madeleine. That must have been like his, you know, his like food that's tied to a memory that will forever bring him back to a time and place. And so I wanted to start off the interview by asking you, what's your Proustian Madeleine and what's the memory and feeling associated with it?
Well, I have a few, I think. Mm-hmm. It's difficult to choose, but it would be between the roast chicken that's in the book and also this chicken liver pasta sauce. I grew up with this. I was born in Portugal. This is a dish that the Portuguese village women taught my mother how to make. And I've been eating it always. So when I was going to cook for Rene the first time, I thought, like, he will not see me like cooking with offal coming. Like this, you know, just turned 20-year-old girl out of school, like, oh yeah, I'm going to cook chicken liver. So I chose to do this because I wanted to make something too that I knew that I could do. I could easily pull it off. I'd made it so many times. And I went grocery shopping, and usually I would put canned tomatoes in there. And I was like, oh my God, I can't bring that into his house. Like, what will he think about me? So I bought tomatoes, fresh tomatoes
wow,
instead.
Wow, you went all out.
So, but I didn't think. I just chopped up these tomatoes and put them in after I'd fried up the sauce. And as soon as I did it, I was like, oh my God, I just ruined everything. It like watered out
because
the sauce.
Because they were too watery.
I should have cooked the tomatoes into a sauce first. But, yeah. You know, whatever. So I had to confess.
Well, it sounds like you impressed him. So,
it worked.
I mean, it doesn't matter. Things worked out for you guys. So what is the first thing? Because you see in the book, and people as they read the book will see that you've been cooking free, kind of self-taught since you were a kid.
Yeah.
Which I'll get into more later. But what is the first thing, and what age were you when you cooked something for yourself and thought, damn, I'm good at this. I can do this. How old were you and what did you make?
Well, I started making porridge, like, mm-hmm. with my knees on a chair, like, stirring the pot. And I quickly observed, like, how I actually needed to remove it from the stove before I thought, you know, take it away before it was actually cooked down to what it would be like when you eat it. Mm-hmm. So it needed to set, like, while it was still kind of wet. And then the oats would absorb the rest, and then it was perfect. Which then turned into me like making scrambled eggs and putting way too many dried spices and all these things. But I learned how to figure out, I like this about this, I don't like this. So changing it all the time until I figured it out. But the first time I felt like I had really cooked like a real meal was when my mother let me rub a chicken with mm-hmm. oil and salt, and I put it in the oven.
It's a very satisfying feeling. I agree with you.
It's amazing.
It's cathartic somehow, just massaging it.
Yes.
Cold
this
chicken
like cold and the salt tickles the palm of your hand.
I love it too. I totally know what you mean.
I mean, it was amazing.
Yeah.
And then just putting this in the oven, and that was it. I mean, I actually like ran to the oven all the time to check like the skin, like is it right? And taking this out of the oven, it's like a full meal here.
Yeah, totally. So I have a question about that because yes. The other night I came home really late and I wanted to like hack my week. So I made two roast chickens and I put them and I was like, I'm gonna have a roast chicken every day for the rest of the week. And then I put them in the oven and one was really golden and beautiful and the other one was cooked through. But the skin was not golden. And the picture of your chicken in your book is like, it is the chicken. I mean, you like want this chicken. You want to like lick the page when you see this chicken. How do you get, what's your secret for getting great skin on a roast chicken?
Like dabbing it off a lot with like paper towel mm-hmm. so that it's completely dry. Mm-hmm. I like to take it, make sure that it's more room temperature. Mm-hmm. And I think cooking it at a lower temperature in the beginning to like just get rid of whatever water or moisture there's still there and then turning it up at the end when it's about done. Mm-hmm. Just it gives the skin like this almost glass crispness to it.
Yeah. Yours looks really good. I need to work on mine a little bit. So I don't know if you noticed, but I'm very pregnant. I'm about to have my first baby.
And very exciting.
It was very exciting. And you have three kids, girls.
Three girls.
And I was like looking through your cookbook and you have, I think there are, I don't know if it's pictures in here. Or maybe I saw pictures of your Instagram. Your kids eat everything. They eat everything. They're amazing. And I was wondering, advice for me. Sorry, everybody who's listening, because I'm totally hijacking this interview right now. Asking advice. How did you teach your kids to be such great eaters? Like, what's your secret? Because all American kids eat beige foods. And I don't want my kid to eat just beige foods. I want them to eat everything.
But I mean, I think they're pretty good eaters, but they could be better. I wish that they would eat everything. But we're getting there. We work on it. I remember them from they're like tiny, sitting in like one of these soft chairs. They're always sitting on the table while I'm cooking. Mm-hmm. The girls are always around when we're cooking. Sometimes they want to help. They're always like fighting about who gets to make the vinaigrette for the salad because I'm like, no, you did it yesterday. I want to do it today. And I think, you know, we try to be careful not to like force them to be into it just because their whole world actually revolves around food when we travel. I mean, it's always about where's the good food? What are we going to eat for breakfast? What are we going to have for lunch? Mm-hmm. All these things. So I think almost giving this, like, you don't need to do this, kind of they want to be there more.
Mm-hmm.
But then, I mean, the book is called Downtime because us sitting around the table is like our family time together. So
I know.
There's this thing that food is everything.
Yeah, like whoever's your neighbor, you live in Copenhagen, right? Properly yeah. In Copenhagen?
Yes.
Whoever's your neighbor must be so psyched because based on the book, it just seems like you have this like a beautiful open door policy where people can just like come over and like sit at your beautiful table and eat this incredible food and like, you know, talk to you about all their problems. And I was like, whoever's their neighbor is so psyched. Question about that though.
Yes.
So I have a beautiful house in Brooklyn that I'm very happy to. And I love it because it's a bigger place and because I can have friends over. And now there's this morning, for example, in my house, there was 8 people around the Amazing. Breakfast table, which was really fun. And I love it like 98% of the time. But sometimes I'm in a grumpy mood and I don't like when guests just stop by. Do you ever experience that? How do you deal with that? Because your house just sounds like people coming and going all the time.
Well, I feel like with them just coming and going, I don't feel like I need to entertain them. It's like if I already ate or whatever, it's like, yeah, there's stuff on the table. Just help yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel like I need to entertain people.
Or just be cooking all the time.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a good policy. Because I immediately feel obligated to like cook something or entertain. And I think sometimes I'm just cranky, especially now that I'm pregnant. I'm just like, So in your book, in your intro, I think, or at some point, I can't remember, maybe it's at the back, towards the back of the book, you talk about, you just breeze by talking about this not-for-profit that you started. And I was curious if you could tell us a little more about that and what you guys do and how long it's been going and just talk about it a little bit.
Well, so MAD started, it's called MAD, which means food in Danish, but obviously a little playing on the words here. But Renee went to a lot of these conferences, and he mostly went because he got to see his good friends from all over the place and wanted to kind of do something where there wasn't a lot of sponsors involved and you had to do all these things that maybe you didn't really want to do, but so that it could be more of like a learning space for each other and to like share. Like it started like most of them were about cooking techniques. You would share cooking techniques. This is about sharing more things. And then Matt would come up with a topic and ask all kinds of people, also like professors, scientists, to come and share. And one of the most amazing things that has come out of Matt is Daniel Patterson and Roy Choi came together and started Local. They met there and found out that they both wanted to do something that could mean something. And now out of this thing called Wild Food has been launched in Denmark, where we've made an app called the Wild Food App, which helps you become a forager in the city.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
It's incredible. And it's going to be a part of school curriculum in Denmark too. So people are going to learn how to forage, but without, you know, taking everything away so nothing comes back next year.
There's a guy here in Brooklyn and in Central Park. I don't know if it's the same guy, but there's a guy here that teaches you how to forage in Prospect Park.
It's amazing.
I thought that would be so much fun. Yeah. And just to go back quickly to what you were saying about Roy Choi and Patterson, because just in case there are people who are listening who don't know, they started a really awesome fast food concept that's very community-based, kind of slow food-oriented in its actual sourcing, right? Is that correct?
Yeah.
But serving up basically like fast food fare responsibly.
Yeah, and trying to make sure that there's actually the amount of nutrients in like a burger that you would need. So I know it has, the meat has like fermented barley inside the patty so that...
Right.
Just to pack it with some good stuff.
And paying staff properly and benefits and all that stuff.
Yeah,
so that was that came out of MAD. That came out of your guys' not-for-profit.
Well, I mean, they met there. I would like to say it just started out of MAD.
It's because of MAD. Just take the credit. In America, we just take credit for things.
Okay. Well, I'll give it to them. They're both incredible people. So,
In your book, you also talk about how sometimes you're like, I mean, it just sounded so, first of all, I've never been to Copenhagen and I'm dying to go. I have a bit of Swedish blood, so I have a family who live in Sweden. And so I imagine there's like a similar-ish vibe.
Yeah.
My boyfriend went to Copenhagen for work this year and came back and was like, we have to move to Copenhagen. It's the best place in the world.
I think especially with kids, it's incredible.
It sounds so fun. And there's this part of your book where you're talking about your grocery shopping routine and you're like on your bike and you're just going from one place to another and you're saying, you know, that you don't really or you didn't really adhere to like recipes for a long time. You just kind of go to a food market and see what was there and figure it out.
Yeah.
And I think for a lot of people, that sounds a little scary. To just have that capability to know that like, oh, a tomato would go well with this, which would go well with that. And so I was wondering if you could give our listeners some of your, you know, rules or guidelines when you're creating a spontaneous meal. Like, is there like a balance of flavor thing that you like to think about? Or like, what's your hack for that?
Well, I've always done this since I was little and I don't know why, but I'm always smelling things and... Smelling something triggers a memory that makes me think of something else. I'm constantly, when I'm eating, trying to separate all the ingredients in there, thinking about what I think goes especially well together.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to read recipes without really thinking about it. I'll just read through them. Any cooking show, I watch it. Not that I write things down, but I think everything gets stored in my head. And then when I'm there, there's something in my head that says, this would be good with this. And I think it's all this, like, just trying to get all this information, but in a very calm way. And then playing around with it, you figure it out in a way. So I think to start coming up with this, like, spontaneous recipes, you have to play around in the kitchen. And it's totally okay for things not to work out. You learn something from it.
Yeah, so perfect, because that's my next segue question. Because you say it's okay to fail in the book, which I totally agree with. I mean, like... Trust me, my brand, Impatient Foodie, is all about failing. So my two questions are, what has been your biggest kitchen fail? And you also say that sometimes at Noma, which I think people would assume that you guys are just like cranking out perfect dishes on the spot, that some of the best stuff on the menu actually started out as big failure. So I was wondering if you could tell us about your biggest cooking fail and then something that was a horrible failure at Noma that now is like a stellar menu item.
Well, one thing that I still can't do properly and it really annoys me, but it's fine. I found a better way to do it now. So poached eggs, like just putting it down into the water.
I love your poached egg hack. I do. We'll get into it in a later, but yeah, okay.
I get so annoyed, like seeing half of the egg white just floating at the top of that water. It's like, oh,
it's also
so
not
annoying.
Appetizing. It looks a little gross.
Yeah, it's like the stuff you skim off when you're like making stock or something.
Totally.
Like, but there's a chef in San Sebastian who actually came up with this way. It's called like the Arzak egg.
Oh, I didn't know what that was called.
Mm. But with this, the way you can put everything into the egg.
Can you explain it?
What you do is you take like a tiny bowl that would fit an open egg. You put a little piece of cling film over the bowl. You have to make sure to put some kind of grease, whether you have chicken fat or just olive oil, whatever you have. This is very important, otherwise the egg is going to stick.
Mm-hmm.
Then you gently open the egg into the cling film, and this is where you could put like any type of herbs. If you have bacon or ham or something, you put that in there. Then you wrap it tightly, tie a knot. You just put in boiling water for 4 minutes. And it's perfect. And you can make like 20 of them at the same time.
which sounds like a dream. I mean, that's 20 perfect. Poached eggs. So I saw the picture in there and I was like, I'm totally going to do that at home. So wait, when we come back from commercial break, I'm going to follow up on that Noma question because okay. I think that's a good one.
Okay.
Le Cordon Bleu, the renowned culinary school, was founded in Paris 122 years ago by a young journalist named Mademoiselle Distel. In 1895, she launched the first weekly culinary magazine called La Cuisinière Le Cordon Bleu. She invited subscribers to take part in free cooking lessons with the chefs featured in her magazine. And from there, the school was born. In the years since, Le Cordon Bleu's world-class instructors have taught French classical culinary techniques to everyone from home enthusiasts to food world legends. If you've dreamt of attending culinary school, maybe it's time to quit that boring corporate job and check out one of Le Cordon Bleu's 35 locations around the world. Or add a short workshop or weekend program at one of its schools to your next vacation. Visit cordonbleu.edu for course descriptions, dates, and online registration. It's all possible at Le Cordon Bleu.
Hey there, Bomb Squad. This is Donna Yen from Team Cherry Bomb. My dog Teddy is a regular at Cherry Bomb HQ, and I care about where his food comes from just as I do my own. That's why Teddy and I are excited about Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Castor and Pollock's new line of pet food is made with ingredients like grass-fed beef and wild-caught salmon. I love that they care about Teddy as much as I do, and as for Teddy, he gives it two paws up.
All right, we are back with Nadine Lavie-Redzepi, author of Downtime, Deliciousness at Home. We were just looking through the book on this break, and I was saying I want to lick every page. It looks so good. Anyway, before we get into the book specifically, I want to get back to that question about a Noma dish that started out as a horrible fail and everyone thought was never going to be anything and now is like a stellar menu item. Do you have any stories about that?
Well, I don't know if there's like a dish in itself, but a lot of these things like ferments and all these things, it's because something happened that wasn't supposed to happen. And then it's like, oh my God, this is amazing. Often they'll have an idea. They're like a whole, you know, they're like five people and they'll brainstorm, talk about ideas. And I think obviously it's always good ideas and it's fine, but it needs to be like better, mm-hmm. way better than fine. So sometimes you forget to, I don't know if they forget to turn off the pot and something cooks down further than it was supposed to.
Story of my life.
But, a lot of good things happen, always. So, and you know, if you're not failing, you're not trying.
Right. That's actually a great motto. I'm going to get that tattooed on my arm. And it's good to know that like all these super professional chefs or incredible chefs like or cooks or home cooks like yourself mess up too. Because I think sometimes a lot of people feel like, oh, I messed up and I burnt that cake. I'm a failure. I'm never going to do it again. But yeah. Actually, everybody totally messes up sometimes. In always. Fact, wait, was it your, I looked up your, Instagram and I looked up your photographer's Instagram and there, you both have a lot of beautiful kind of photos and videos of your children. And there was one video that made me laugh so much where, I think it was yours, where you gave your little daughter a slice of cake and the tagline was like, kids are always honest. And your kid was like, bleh, no.
Yeah. That was like my favorite cake that she was like, but so in all fairness, there was, I make really good brownies and they were also there. So she just, so she wanted though. Those.
I know. She immediately like that turned one. To I mean, something. That one. Yeah. And she immediately turned and pointed at something. And I just thought it was such a cute video. Like, no filter.
Brutal.
Brutal. You know, that's what it is.
Get used to it. It's coming.
So dishes from the book that I wanted to just kind of talk about. First of all, I want to let you know that tonight I am making your baked salmon with thyme and thin potatoes.
Nice.
It looks so good. I am so excited. And then a few other things that I totally stood out to me in the book. I mean, everything did, especially the egg cooking technique that we've already discussed. But I'm a big pasta girl, so your seal the deal pasta. That was such a great, can you tell us this little story about that? It's such a great little story.
So when Renee and I met, the restaurant was open 6 days a week. And on Sundays, he would go in and like do a salary, make work schedules. Like he just worked all the time. He was a machine. So Noma closed down for Christmas. So I was actually going to spend 5 full days with Renee for the first time. And he was going to cook for me. And there had been like some leftover muskox and some lobster and all these things at the restaurant. So we took that home. And the first thing Renee cooked for me was this pasta, which it's a beurre blanc sauce. And he peeled the tomatoes and decored them. When he put it on the table, I kind of thought, that's it. Like... It looks
like this guy, Noma chef.
I was like, that looks so simple. I get. It's like, but you know, then I tasted it and like everything, it just went quiet. Like this, it was so, so good. And like he served lobster and the muskox later, but the pasta was like the thing. So Renee likes to joke around saying that this is
the sealed the, a deal pasta.
That's what did it. So that's
it looks beautiful. I'm gonna make that too. Oh my god. And I just flipped to the page that I meant to flip to, which is a sign from God that I'm right. I wanna eat this lasagna. Lasagna with sausage and meatballs. Like every day for the rest of my life. This photo, when you get the book, everybody, you will see this photo and you will literally just run out and buy the ingredient. I can't believe how delicious this looks. This is incredible. This is like my dream food. So I'm just going to take and make it this weekend as well. And then the other thing that I noticed was that when you make an omelet, you put rice in it.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was so interesting. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, so Noma did a pop-up in Japan. And one of the things that we noticed that we all leaned towards, like the whole family, was eating rice with something. Mm-hmm. So we bought a rice cooker as soon as we got home, and we have rice for breakfast quite often, and had a lot of rice left over, more than I had expected, or I'd made too much, I'm not sure. And I was thinking about David Chang's like rice cakes and spicy sausage dish at Momofuku, mm-hmm. Soundbar. Mm-hmm. I love the texture of these like rice balls in this dish. I was like, maybe if I take this rice and just like fry it up, and then I tasted like a piece of it while I was cooking, I was like, I need to put this in an omelet. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those, again, like playing around, like just going with whatever your little voice in your head is telling you to do. I had this moment where I was like, I am a genius. This is so good. I cannot wait to make this for Renee.
It looks so good. I mean, and again, the pictures in your book are so beautiful. And can you talk about your photographer a little bit? I looked her up, but the, you know, people at home don't know.
I mean, Dida Isaya is her name. She's amazing. She works a lot with natural light. I've known Dida for like 11 years, 12 years. She shot the photos for Renee's books also, which of course are different, but I knew that with Dida, she would totally get this thing of me wanting to have photos in the book that were just the food and like showcased it the way that it is. Like none of, you know, just twigs of leaves or whatever, stuff that doesn't need to be there. We don't have that when we sit down and eat.
It's very Copenhagen chic aesthetic. Yeah,
it's very Scandinavian.
It is. It's very Scandinavian chic. So, sorry, I just realized I had a question about something. Going back to the rice for a second. Mm-hmm. Like, I am actually really embarrassed to admit that I'm not good at cooking rice. I mean, I'm fine. I can cook rice. You know what I mean? Like, it's pretty easy. But, like, I don't have a rice cooker. So, before you had a rice cooker, do you have any good advice on how to make, like, a good, fluffy rice? What am I doing wrong? I always feel like my rice is, like, a little gloppy. A little bit.
I think Renee told me this when we just met. Because mm-hmm. I felt like it always got, like, a little sticky, like in a bad way. I mean, if it's sticky rice, then it's supposed to be. But the trick with rice is to actually just not touch it at all.
Oh, that's nice. Just leave it alone.
Leave it alone.
Yeah, I guess I kind of pester my rice. I kind of open the thing and like, just shake it around.
If you stir it, you mess it up completely.
Oh, interesting.
So it's like double the amount of water as rice, salt, give it a stir, then you turn it on, and then don't touch it.
You know,
at all.
one of my favorite things that I don't, this is like going back to the little voice in the head thing. Once I had the black rice, the black sticky rice, which is so good. I mean, I don't even remember where I tried it, but I bought it. And then I did, rather than cooking it in water, I dumped a can of coconut milk and coconut water in there and just let, that was like, and that's all I ate for like a week. I was just like that rice. It was so, I think I put like a fried egg on it sometimes. It is so good. But I mean, a good rice is really just so good.
Yeah, or any type of grains. I like cooking like pearl barley, but instead of using water, I'll use the chicken stock that I made off of the roast chicken. It's so, so good.
Ooh, chickens. I'm gonna do that too. I have so many things to cook for Cream of Coke. I'm so excited. So what is your favorite dish from this book?
Oh my God.
You already said the roast chicken, so you can't say that again.
No.
Second favorite, if there is one.
I think it's impossible to choose a favorite dish. It's it depends on so many things, like what time of year is it, how much did I eat today, how am I feeling? Mm-hmm. So it changes all the time.
I think, well, I'll write you after I write my book, but I'm really excited about basically everything, especially, I'm not a big baker, but I really liked your do-it-all cake. That seemed so easy. Can you talk about that a little bit? I mean, you also have a giant macaron cake, which we'll talk about in a second, but your do-it-all cake is a really cool name and concept. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, so I was looking for a really good, like, base cake recipe, and I was trying a lot of things, and it was just annoying me because none of them, they were good, but they weren't what I wanted it to be. So I was talking to Rocio Sanchez, who was back then the pastry chef at Noma. And she gave me this like lemon oil pound cake recipe where I stripped it down a little bit, moved some things. And I mean, it was brilliant cake the way that she gave it to me, but like to do it like this where you can use it for a million things. It's just, it's so rich and so dense.
Yeah.
And I mean, it goes with everything.
And it seems like, you could like put whipped cream on it or fruit or like I was like, oh, I'm going to like zap up some Nutella and like drizzle it on there. Like it's one of those cakes you can just kind of make anything.
Yes.
So smart.
So good.
I love that. I love these kinds of hacks. So talk to us a little bit about, because you talk about it towards the end of your book, how you learn to cook. Because it's really interesting. And you kind of are self-taught and they have a great story around that. So I was wondering if you could recap that for us.
Well, I think I just always really enjoyed eating. I thought, you know, for the longest time, I thought I wanted to be a chef. We had career week at school, which is, when I think about when I tell this story, I'm realizing how amazing it is that they do that in public schools, where the school finds you like a workplace after you tell them like two or three things that you'd like to try. I went to this kitchen because I knew I liked to cook. And I found out when I was there that I just want to be a really good cook for me. Mm-hmm. I want to sit down and eat everything I make with whoever's there. So I thought about maybe I should train to be a chef when I grow up or when I get older, just to use it for me. But it seemed like just playing around in the kitchen myself and trying to absorb as much about food as I possibly could was the perfect way. So when I met Renee, I would call him all the time when I wasn't working, when he had his like 15-minute break. I was like, Renee, you know that squid thing, you know, with, how do you do that? Can I do that at home? I bought it already. So like, what do you do? So
I need to know right now.
Yes. Tell me before you go back to work.
But you also talk about how you learned how to cook just by, when you were a small child, watching cooking shows.
Yes.
That you got sick of Days of Our Lives.
Yes.
Is that the soap opera? Which I loved. And you just started flipping on a cooking channel. And what was the guy that you watched again?
It was a program called Ready, Steady, Cook, mm-hmm. where this English chef called Ainsley Harriott was the host. And this show was about having, they had two chefs and then they had two normal people who I guess wrote the program saying that they never knew what to cook, whatever. So they would have to bring five ingredients that they had bought to this competition that it actually was. And then the chefs with them, but I mean, the people didn't actually do anything. The chefs would cook three dishes in 20 minutes. It was amazing, and all because it was stuff.
I feel like
from
we need
Supermarket.
This show now in yes. the world. Is it
I
around?
Think so too. Yeah. I don't think so.
Oh, what a bummer!
Brilliant,
because all the cooking shows now are like great and fun to watch, but like totally useless application wise.
This was incredible.
Yeah. Okay. Amazing. So yeah. I thought that was really interesting that you basically got taught by how to cook by TV.
Completely.
And apparently went to the best public school ever that gave you a career week, and that's so awesome.
Yeah. No. That. And then this guy Antonio Carluccio.
Mm-hmm.
And yes. then, you know, Jamie Oliver came, Nigella Lawson. I'm still obsessed with their shows. Just watching them, you always take something away from them. It's like, oh, I could use this. Like, this is good.
Yeah, especially like Jamie and Nigella. They're always very practical.
Yeah,
I like
it's
that
amazing.
About them. Yeah, very much. So you worked at NoMA.
Yes.
You worked at many different jobs. And I had two questions yes. about that. One is, I worked in restaurants for a little while. I was a waitress. And my personal biggest takeaway from working in restaurants was how to not treat people, because people are not nice to the wait staff or just staff of restaurants in general. And I was wondering what your main takeaway, what was your like, I'm going to totally force my kids to work at a restaurant because it is a crash course and a lot of things. and I was wondering, what was your experience working as a server there? What were your big life lessons? Because you were working there when you were quite young, right?
Yeah. This thing with not necessarily, I mean, obviously you're trying to please people and make them happy, but more trying to think about what you yourself like and which environment you like to step into, and then trying to create that and hoping that that's what other people will also enjoy being around. And I think that's very much a good picture or a caption of how Renee is as a person. That's why NoMA is what it is, because it's all based around him thinking about what experience he would like.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the same when we have people coming over at home. People are always asking, like, oh, are you nervous if, like, Chang is coming for dinner if he's in Copenhagen? And, I mean, it's very exciting. I'm not going to lie. But
you're like, whatever, Chang.
Yeah. I have known him for a very long time. But, you know, I think just taking a basis in what you'd like to eat yourself, mm-hmm. and then cooking that
and pouring love into it. I always yeah. feel like people ask me the same thing, and I'm always like, look, people are just psyched to like get an invitation. Well, I mean, NoMA's different, obviously, but like to come to your house and eat a home cooked yeah. meal. Like, they don't really care what they eat.
Well, I mean,
so much. They can go out for a pizza afterwards.
If people are gonna like
they need to
like fault you on little things when you invite them to your home,
yeah,
like for a home cooked meal. I don't want to be friends with them anyway. It's like,
totally.
You know,
you're right.
Yeah. Never come back.
And then the million-dollar question, mm-hmm. you were a reservationist at NoMA.
Yes.
And you have a lot of really great stories about people trying to finagle reservations out of you. So I was wondering if you could give us little tips on how to get a reservation at NoMA, or just any restaurant we're trying to get into in general. Like, is there anything that ever works? Or it's just like there are reservations and you're booked for 5 years and that's just it. That's
well,
the end.
I mean, we thought about it a lot, like how to do this. And like, there aren't really any tricks to getting a table at NoMA, because we wanted it to be as fair as possible. No one has any advantages. Mm-hmm. It goes up like 3 months ahead and it's open for everyone. It's just about being first on the computer.
Okay. So just wake up early. That's usually the answer for everything in life.
<It's>
just
horrible.
Get there for everyone else.
Yeah. No, and like, I think waiting lists, like, it's actually like you should always add yourself to the waiting list, because there's always stuff that comes up and people cancel or get sick or whatever.
Oh, that's good to know, because I always felt like the waiting list was a bit of like a throwaway. You know what I mean? Like trying to make me feel better, but like I'm not actually. But actually, it happens. You do get moved from waiting list to reservation.
We used it a lot.
Oh, okay. There you go. See?
Yeah.
Good takeaway. So I have, this is a kind of a more personal question. Well, two personal questions, actually. So, you know, I worked in fashion for a long time, and I come from a family that worked in fashion and in cinema. So I always struggled a little bit with kind of feeling like I was making a name for myself or carving out a niche for myself. And now I work in food, and now my mom runs a farm. So now she's even getting into the food thing. So I can't even get away from that. But, you know, so I feel like I got a little more independence. But I was wondering with, you know, you've created this incredible cookbook. You're an incredible cook. Do you ever feel that with Renee, or is that just not something that affects you that much?
I don't feel it so much. Renee is amazing and always very supportive and very, very proud. When I did go into this thing that, okay, I'm going to make this book, I was very well aware that certain doors would be open for me just because of my last name. And I was like, that's fine because they'll forget about it soon. Like, as soon as I see that it's really good, it'll be fine.
Yeah, you're probably right. And then the other question is, you know, this is a bit of a personal question, so I'm sorry if I'm overstepping bounds, but I had to ask.
Okay.
Your life in Copenhagen seems really perfect, beautiful. We're all really happy for you and everything. But does Renee ever, like, mansplain things to you when you're cooking in the kitchen? Is he ever like, oh, you're mincing that wrong, and here's, and you're just like, dude, back off. Like, I got this. Or is he just totally, like, totally cool?
He totally, like, butts out at home.
Really?
Like, he doesn't.
All right, so your life really is perfect. I was hoping we were gonna get some, like, yes, he mansplains all the time, but no,
cool, he'll guy. Be like, wow, this is incredible, this is better than the last time, what did you do?
Nice.
Or he could also say, I liked it better the last time.
And is it hard to, like, are you guys, I mean, I remember I dated a chef, like, you know, when I was younger, and I came away feeling like, God, it's hard to date a chef because, like, when everyone else is off, they're on, you know, like Christmas or New Year's, like, that's when they're going gangbusters and you're at home with your family trying to chill. Like, do you guys ever find a hard time balancing that, or not really?
I mean, I think obviously after having kids, it's harder for him. I mean, I'm very well aware that he loves to work and that he would be working, like, always, like, no matter what happened. He made that very clear to me when we started seeing each other, because, you know, he'd seen lots of colleagues where they'd been together for, like, 2 years, and then it would be like, okay, it's time to have a family. You need to quit your job and, like, work in a canteen so that you're home every night. So it's very important for him to let me know that that was not going to happen.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we go on these trips in the winter. We usually go to Mexico, where he and the kids have a really nice, intense amount of time together. And we live in a house now that's, like, a 5-minute walk from where the restaurant was. It will now be a 10-minute bike ride instead. But since we moved so close, he comes home every night between the lunch and dinner service.
Oh, nice. So you have a little
moment. Yeah, it's great. Mm. And then, you know, when he is there, he's totally there. Like, we have this thing, like, it's better he stays at work an hour later or whatever, but finish it so that when you are home, then
you're present.
You're there.
Nice, nice. It just occurred to me that your kids probably have the best school lunches in their entire district. Like, maybe even in all of Europe. Do they? Do they, like, come to school with incredible things? Or do they get, like, a school lunch and that's just the way it is?
No, actually, I don't really think there are any schools that serve, like, school meals. You could buy, like, a sandwich that was made 6 hours ago or something.
Gross.
But we make their sandwiches or their lunch boxes. And again, thinking about what would we want to eat if we had a lunchbox. So lots of little boxes in the lunchbox with different things, and always make a little extra dinner so that there are things from dinner that they can have in the lunchbox.
So, I mean, if I was, you know, in your daughter's school in her class, I would totally, like, sit next to her to do lunch swaps with her.
It happens. But, you know, sometimes it always has the other effect. Our daughter told me the other day that she had traded her really nice charcuterie for an Oreo. I was like, you did what? You traded the wrong way.
How old is she?
She's 6.
Okay, 6. I mean, that's totally reasonable 6-year-old trade.
Got a better deal than you.
My last question before we have to go is, where is your book tour taking you from here, and where can people find you?
Well, I am going to drop by LA because I've never been and I really want to go on Wednesday. And then after that, I'm off to Denmark. But then from mid-November, I will be in England with the book.
Fun. Well, if you do any cooking demos, I'm sure lots of people would love to come try your food and meet you. It's such a delight to have you here today. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for today's show, everybody. Thanks always, as always, to our engineer, Dave Tadashor. Dave, did I say that right? Sorry. I don't know. How do I say your name?
Tadashor.
Tadashor. That's hard.
Yeah.
They also like, whatever, I'm gonna let it go. Thanks, Dave. And much love to Castor and Pollux for making this season of Radio Cherry Bomb possible. If you're a devoted pet parent, please be sure to check out Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. And as always, we'd like to say a big thank you to Le Cordon Bleu. Be sure to visit cordonbleu.edu for information about this legendary cooking school. And be sure to catch Carrie and the Cherry Bomb team on the road with the cookbook, the Cherry Bomb Cook the Cookbook. Woohoo! Whoop, whoop, whoop. Carrie, really miss you. Awesome. It's such a great cookbook, guys. I'm so proud of you. And don't forget to take part in the International Women's Supper Club. Email your girlfriends right now. I'm going to do it when I get home. And check out cherrybomb.com for the giveaways, recipes, and more. I've had so much fun filling in today. I can't believe that was an hour. That went by in a second. I had pizza. I had great chat. I got to like go through a beautiful cookbook. This is the best day ever. Thank you for having me. And thanks for listening, everybody. You're the bomb.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Collins, and I'm the creator and host of FMB Radio, a Charleston-based comedy podcast that takes ridiculous laughs and adventures. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and Heritage Radio Network. To subscribe or learn more about the magazine, visit cherrybomb.com. You know who I think is the bomb? Cynthia Wong, and here's why. First of all, she's the head pastry chef and baker at Butcher & Bee in Charleston, South Carolina. But she's just super dry, witty. Her sense of humor is like a super potty mouth child, but genius all at the same time. And she created probably the most craveable version of a whoopie pie ever. It's called a fatty cake. Check her out.